Higher-than-expected growth also means heightened concern about inflation. Inflation was a pretty big worry even before these latest numbers. Consumer prices were up more than 5% in July compared to a year ago. It's the biggest jump in nearly 20 years. President Reagan once said inflation is as violent as a mugger, as frightening as an armed robber, and as deadly as a hitman. NPR's Chris Arnold explains.
This would be a good sound for a video game about that deadly hitman. You could call it Inflation Hitman 2000. But it's actually coming from a high-tech sheet metal cutting machine on the factory floor at a company called Metalworks in New Hampshire. Fred Pierce is the CEO.
It sounds like some kind of machine gun or something.
Yeah, well, what we're doing is we're punching out different shapes on a flat piece of steel. So we can create any shape part that someone designs.
The company makes parts for medical X-ray equipment and all kinds of other stuff, but Metalworks has been getting hurt by rising costs of raw materials.
Steel, aluminum, stainless steel, copper, all those prices have gone up dramatically in the last, really, 8 months. So since January, the price of steel is up between 70 and 80%. It's not something that we can absorb.
What's been happening is that a lot of developing countries' economies have been growing like crazy, and that's created strong demand for things like steel and oil. For a while, U.S. companies tried to make up the difference by becoming more productive and efficient, but more are now trying to pass the higher costs along to customers. Dean Mackey is chief U.S. economist at Barclays Capital.
I think there are a lot of reasons to be concerned about the inflation outlook. It seems that we've reached a sort of tipping point.
Mackey says the weak dollar has been forcing foreign competitors to raise prices here in the U.S., and that makes it easier for companies here to pass along at least some of the higher costs that are squeezing them.
20% of small businesses say inflation is their single biggest problem at this point. We haven't seen those kind of numbers since the early 1980s, and they are responding by raising prices. We think the overall inflation picture continues to be quite worrisome.
Back at the Metalworks factory, Fred Pierce is raising his prices, too.
We're trying to raise ours between 5 and 7%.
Around the country, that's about how much consumer prices have risen over the past year. Wholesale prices are up nearly 10%. That's a big jump. But Fred Pierce also says his sales are down 20%. Competition from abroad is still tough. And that definitely stops U.S. companies from raising their prices as much as they'd like to.
Yeah, absolutely. We lost two big projects in the last year, one that went to China and one that went to Mexico.
So I guess that's a clear signal you can't raise prices that much or you're going to lose business.
That's exactly right, yeah.
So Pierce says he can't afford to offer much in the way of wage increases right now. Eric DuPont is one of the workers here who runs the big metal punching machines.
Right. I'm just very happy I have a job right now, especially with the workload decreasing because of all the economy and stuff like that. It's, yeah, making it real tough for us lower level guys to live.
Metalworks has cut back overtime hours, so DuPont's making less money and paying more for gas and food. He commutes 50 miles each way. He says he and his fiance are trying to save up for their wedding, and they're cutting back on other spending.
We no longer have cable. We don't have a phone at home right now. We have cell phones, so trying to get help with daycare assistance through the state right now. I don't want to complain about my own home financial situation, but it's really tough.
If enough consumers cut back on spending, it'll be difficult for inflation to race ahead the way that it's been doing recently. Energy and commodity prices have started to fall back down a bit. Alan Blinder is an economist at Princeton who sees the glass half full here.
And it is almost perfectly predictable. Something very strange would have to happen for this not to be true, that inflation will fall dramatically.
Economist Dean Mackey disagrees. He thinks inflation may fall a bit, but he says the strong GDP numbers out today suggest that the economy isn't yet slowing down enough to really put a damper on inflation. So he's still concerned. Meanwhile, the Federal Reserve will be watching closely, ready to intervene if prices keep rising this quickly. Chris Arnold, NPR News.
Presidential candidates John McCain and Barack Obama are promising to help the middle class, which is telling pollsters it could use some help. So how do you explain this? There's new data from the Census Bureau this week showing that middle-class incomes are rising. To try to explain what's going on, we've brought in David Wessel, regular guest here and economics editor of the Wall Street Journal. David, good morning once again.
Good morning, Steve.
So what is happening with middle-class incomes?
Well, the good news is that middle-class incomes, the income of the family at the smack in the middle of the middle class, rose in 2007 for the third year in a row. And the wages of full-time, year-round workers adjusted for inflation was also up after 3 years of decline.
You said right in the middle. What kind of figure are we talking about here?
The household at the middle of the middle class makes about $50,000. The issue is that that increase doesn't bring the middle of the middle class back to where it was at the late 90, early 2000 period when the economy had been growing. So we've gone through this period of 6 years of economic growth from 2001 to 2007, and the middle class has finally got itself back to where it was before the last recession. And that's not the way things are supposed to work.
And even more immediately, I suppose, people are wondering if the raise they got is enough to deal with the escalating cost of gasoline and food and energy and everything else.
Well, we're talking inflation-adjusted numbers, but the problem is the Census Bureau this week gave us a snapshot of 2007, and here in 2008, we know things are definitely worse today than they were when they took this snapshot.
Okay, so you're giving us some nuances of something that's often talked about, the so-called stagnation of the middle class. And you're telling us over the last 8 years or so, during this decade, people have pretty much broken even, done no better than they were. What about people at the top of the income scale?
Well, people at the top have done very well in general. And that's one of the distinguishing features of this period. The new census data, though, actually show a slight decline in inequality, the way they measure it, not nearly enough to undo the widening we've seen over the past couple of decades. And there's some problems with their numbers. When the census does its numbers, you can't make more than $999,999. So if you got a raise from $1 million to $2 million, you didn't get a raise at all in their numbers.
And if somebody got a raise from $40 million to $50 million, which some people do, it counts for nothing.
It doesn't count for nothing in this particular set of numbers. But other numbers tell us that the people at the very top are doing very well.
And continuing to do very well, even in tough economic times. So do you notice the presidential candidates adjusting their rhetoric at all to deal with these changes?
I don't think they'll adjust their rhetoric. It was actually pretty funny. Both Senator Obama and Senator McCain issued statements immediately after the Census Bureau put out the numbers. Senator McCain talked about an economic plan that would restore bottom-up economic growth. And Senator Obama talked about economic growth designed from the ground up.
Oh,
both aimed at the middle class.
Definite difference, then. You can vote for the bottom guy or the ground guy.
But in the statements, they captured what is the essence of their different economic philosophy. Senator Obama talked about investing in energy and education and infrastructure and using the tax code to make the distribution of income more equal. Senator McCain did not talk about using the tax code to make things more equal and talked about creating jobs by keeping taxes low.
So even though we have these two rather interesting, almost exotic candidates on either side, it sounds like the economic argument gets down to the same Democratic-Republican economic argument that's been going on for decades.
Very much so.
David Wessel, The Wall Street Journal, thanks for coming by.
You're welcome.
Tonight, Barack Obama will be addressing the party faithful. Starting tomorrow, though, he and his running mate Joe Biden will face a tougher audience. They're planning a joint bus trip through Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Michigan, all battleground states where those financial worries that Michelle just mentioned are issue number one. Obama and Biden will be stressing bread-and-butter economics, as NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
Pennsylvania, where Barack Obama travels tomorrow, is home to a lot of blue-collar workers who aren't yet sold on his platform. That's one reason Joe Biden was chosen, to help balance the ticket. Biden, the son of a Scranton car dealer, wasted no time last night telling working-class Democrats he's one of them.
I'm here for everyone I grew up with in Scranton and Wilmington. I'm here for the cops and the firefighters, the teachers and the assembly line workers, the folks whose lives are the very measure of whether the American dream endures.
Biden stressed that Obama has also worked his way up. Raised by a single mom, Obama passed up a lucrative career on Wall Street to work instead as a community organizer and later a state senator.
And because Barack Obama made that choice, working families in Illinois pay less taxes and more people have moved from welfare to the dignity of work, and he got it done.
Democrats are counting on those biographical details to make a connection with blue-collar voters that Obama's policy prescriptions haven't. Obama's promise not to raise taxes on anyone making less than $200,000 a year. But Republican John McCain is still running ads like this one, claiming he's the watchdog of the working-class wallet.
If elected president, Obama's promises would mean even more taxes, painful taxes, when times are tough enough.
According to the Tax Policy Center in Washington, 80% of American families would do better under Obama's tax plan. Only the wealthiest 20% would pad their pocketbooks more under McCain's proposal. Nevertheless, McCain told an audience in Racine, Wisconsin last month, the benefits of his tax cuts would, in effect, trickle down.
I'm going to keep current tax rates low and cut others, and not because I want to make the rich richer, but because it keeps jobs in America and it creates new ones.
Obama's campaign has tried to counter that argument with a little history. Obama advisor Jared Bernstein of the Economic Policy Institute notes the U.S. added 22 million jobs while Bill Clinton was president, and tax rates were similar to those Obama has proposed. That's almost four times as many jobs as were added during the tax-cutting tenure of George Bush.
22 million in the 90s, 5.6 million in the 2000s. That, by the way, that 2000s record, the worst record for job growth in the history of these data going back to 1939.
Democrats insist McCain would merely extend President Bush's lackluster economic record. But the charge hasn't necessarily stuck. McCain's running close behind Obama in Pennsylvania and slightly ahead in Ohio. The Arizona senator's tax-cutting promise is a simpler sell than Obama's more nuanced policy. And McCain's also hit a nerve with his newfound energy prescription, drill here, drill now. Montana's Democratic Governor Brian Schweitzer tried to shatter McCain's drill bit at the convention this week while poking fun at the senator's inability to remember how many houses he owns.
If you drilled in all of John McCain's backyards, even the ones he doesn't know he has, that single answer proposition is a dry well.
McCain's gaffe about his seven houses, like his comment that rich begins at $5 million, could provide the kind of useful bumper sticker shorthand Democrats have been looking for as they reach beyond the Obama fans at Mile High Stadium and try to win over skeptical working class voters living a lot closer to the ground. Scott Horsley, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Among all the bad economic news, we begin this hour with some movement in the positive direction. It turns out that during the spring of this year, the U.S. economy was growing much faster than anyone thought. A report out today on the gross domestic product suggests there's a disconnect between what people are experiencing, the job losses, the foreclosures, and what one of the government's most important statistics is indicating. Here's NPR's John Itzde.
Today's GDP report said the U.S. economy had raced ahead during April, May, and June, growing at an annual rate of 3.3%. That's a very robust pace, says economist Nigel Galt of the consulting firm Global Insight.
That's quite a surprising outcome, given all the bad news we've been having over the economy.
Right, like record home foreclosures, rising unemployment, a credit crisis, billions in losses at financial and auto companies, and your 401k leaking money like a rusty bucket. So what gives? How can the GDP number be so disconnected from what many Americans are feeling? The answer, says Galt, is that we may be producing more, but we're shipping much of it overseas.
We may be producing more output, but we're not actually able to use it for our own benefit, for our own consumption.
Of course, Americans have built a lifestyle importing mountains of goods and services and consuming much more than we produce. So it's no wonder we've got the blues now that that's unwinding. Kent Jubick, president of Ajax & Sons, a company that produces small metal parts like hinges and brackets in Fridley, Minnesota, some of them for export, he says there's a good deal of gloom in the community. People talking about the housing slowdown and foreclosures.
I could go on and on and on about the doomsday, but we've seemed to do very well in the last 6 months in a slow economy.
In fact, the company's exports to China have doubled in the past 2 years. And the surge in exports apparent in today's GDP report comes as no surprise to Dyke Messenger, who runs a factory in Salisbury, North Carolina.
We've seen a nice growth in our exports this year on top of good growth last year, and it's coming from all over the world.
Messenger is president of Power Curbers Incorporated, which produces machines that make concrete curbs and gutters for streets on site like a paving machine. He says sales are strong in South America, Europe, Asia, North Africa, and the Middle East. But despite 20% increases in exports in the past 2 years, his profits are down because U.S. sales are suffering.
When you're down 30% domestically, that 20% increase in international still doesn't bring you back to the level that you need to be.
Unfortunately for manufacturers and the U.S. economy, says Nigel Galt, the export surge may not continue.
Certainly going to continue to see support from exports, but it's hard to believe we're going to see as much support as we did in the second quarter when export growth was 13%.
That's because foreign economies are beginning to slow, especially in Europe, and the weak dollar, which has made U.S. goods much more competitive, appears to have bottomed out and, in fact, has strengthened in recent weeks. John Itzde, NPR News, Washington.